Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Vanished ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
The way I found out about Dennis's disappearance is his friends up there forced a TV news broadcast on it. And my nephew, who lives a couple of hundred miles away, saw it and reported it to me. And that's when I called the police department. We see that Dennis's car is still there. His finances haven't been touched. He left his animals, which he loved dearly. This isn't my brother.
Nobody's come forward to me to say, hey, I saw Dennis on this day. Typically what we find when we get a missing person, 9 times out of 10, they're usually found at a friend's house. They're usually, or you have the dementia patient who walks away from the home, we find them down the street. Typically they're found rather quickly. We have an excellent search and rescue team, the county does. You're talking four-wheelers, horseback, helicopters, I mean, all the stops come out. On this particular case, I mean, I was 2 weeks behind the ball already. No idea which, if he did leave on his own, which way did he go? He obviously didn't take his car, so once I get to the end of the driveway, which way do I go? That's been the tough part, and just no trail.
Dennis Day is well known as being one of the original Mickey Mouse Club Mouseketeers. He was just 12 years old back in 1955 when he was hired to appear on the show. But that was a long time ago and only a small part of Dennis's life. Fast forward 63 years to July 15th, 2018. Now 76-year-old Dennis Day told his roommate that he was going to visit some friends for a few days and left on foot from his home in Phoenix, Oregon. 2 days prior, Dennis's husband Ernie was taken to the hospital by ambulance after a fall, and he had been placed in a nursing home because their home was not considered safe by law enforcement and hospital staff. Dennis's husband Ernie suffers from some memory problems and was unable to describe what Dennis looked like currently, who his friends were, or if he had any family. In the 8 months since Dennis disappeared, his loved ones have embarked on a mission to find out what happened to him. But they've been left with more questions than answers. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 168 of The Vanished, Dennis Day's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. Dennis's disappearance has been covered in the media recently, and he's most well known for having been one of the first Mouseketeers in the Mickey Mouse Club in the 1950s. When I began researching this case, I wanted to know what the person in the photos wearing those mouse ears was like. So we spoke to Dennis's longtime friend, Roseanne. Roseanne spearheaded the search for Dennis after his disappearance last summer and runs the Facebook page aimed at helping to find him. She told us how she met Dennis.
After high school, I lived in Southern California, and the Renaissance Fair was brought to my attention, and I went, and I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. And then a high school friend of mine, she got involved with the fair. And one of the reasons she did is because she lived up north by that time. And her English teacher was an actor at the fair and got the class participating. And, you know, she became friends with Dennis immediately. When the fair came down south after that northern fair, I and another friend started doing it. Immediately, I met Dennis, who was a very important director for the fair at that time. And I was a volunteer. And he cast me in the big pageant that was done at the fair, which was done for the Queen show, and that he had written and he acted in. He was so smart and talented and inventive and funny and all those things. And we just had a mutual sense of humor and we hung out. And when he got involved with Ernie and moved up to San Francisco, and I, by that time, lived in Oakland, I loved Ernie. We saw each other back and forth. I'd have dinner over there. They'd have dinner over at my house. Dennis and I both loved to cook. We both loved animals. That was another connection. When I got married as a young woman, that did not last, but Ernie was was the person who married us.
Dennis moved to Phoenix, Oregon in the 1980s with his husband, Ernie Caswell. The pair were well known around town as the couple with larger-than-life personalities. Dennis and Ernie spent many years active in the local Renaissance festivals, owned a gourmet mustard company, and sang in a community men's choir. Roseanne shared some of the ways that Dennis and Ernie engaged in the activities in their local community and what their life was like.
He did wine jellies at the fair for a few more fairs, and then they moved to Oregon. Very few people really have seen him since, and he became a bit of a recluse too, because he, at base, is a very shy person. It was just doing that acting persona kind of allowed him to be out there and engaged. When I started the page, within about a week, maybe a week and a half, I had 350 members. Most of them had been people, you know, who knew them directly, and most of them were fair people, although a certain amount of the Oregon people.
Roseanne met Dennis when they were young, but she hasn't seen him in over 30 years. I wanted to get an idea of what Dennis was like later in life. So we spoke to his and Ernie's close friend, Kirk, who resides not far from where Dennis and Ernie lived in Phoenix, Oregon. Kirk spoke about how he met the pair.
I have probably been their best friend in the last 15 years. And I met Ernie because we both volunteered and were working with the gay community. So I got to know him there. And then he and I and three other gentlemen were the starters of the Rogue Valley Gay Men's Chorus, which had a run of about 12 years. So I sang with Ernie for 12 years and got to know Dennis, who for much of his adult life has been a bit reclusive because he just didn't tolerate lots of people. And I live outside of Phoenix, so we became quick friends, and I spent lots of time with them over the last stretch of years. And Dennis, because of his, he's a bit eclectic, and he just didn't accept everybody. And so I reached out to him repeatedly, and it took even a couple of years of the friendship with Ernie before he really decided he liked me and started opening up to me. He loved life in a big way, but like I say, didn't have time for lots of people. His passion over the last years was he was a picker, so he went to yard sales every Friday and Saturday. My favorite comment about him is he's kind of a leprechaun. So he flitted about and he always wore crazy hats. He and Ernie both, I would take them to Hometown Buffet was a favorite place to go to get a variety of food. And Ernie would wear this outlandish red velvet pimp hat. And Dennis always had some loud hat and some loud garment. There were loud colors, something he liked. He didn't care. He was an amazing actor and quite the accomplished tap dancer. One of the favorite stories I've heard so far was one guy surfaced that said he actually worked with Dennis as a bank teller in the very early days. And he was always cutting up and would step out of the elevator and just start tap dancing, and everybody would stop what they were doing and gather around. He loved living outside the lines and being out there and could care less what anybody thought. He was on my front porch the day he was last seen by anybody. He was there. He said, "I need your help." I said, well, what do you need? He said, I need your help in getting Dan out of my house. He told me that Dan had assaulted him and knocked him down.
A few weeks before Ernie was moved to a nursing home, a local handyman named Daniel had moved in with them to work on cleaning up their house and to help with Ernie's care. 2 days prior to his disappearance, Dennis's husband Ernie fell and had to be taken to the hospital. The local authorities had determined that it was unsafe for Ernie to return home, and the hospital staff arranged for him to be placed at a nearby nursing home. According to the roommate Daniel, on July 15th, Dennis told him that he was going to visit some friends and left on foot. Dennis was never seen or heard from again. On July 17th, 2018, just 2 days after Daniel says that Dennis left on foot, the police department received a welfare check request from the hospital. They were concerned that Dennis had not come to visit Ernie, and they weren't able to reach him. An officer went out to the home and noted that the car was there, but there was no one inside. An officer went to speak to Ernie, who mentioned that Dennis had told him that he was leaving for a couple days, which is similar to what Daniel had said. One odd aspect of this case is that while Daniel claims that Dennis walked away, how could he have gone to visit friends without his car or any money? After Dennis vanished, a police officer made contact with Daniel and made a strange discovery. Phoenix Police Department Lieutenant Price is investigating Dennis's case. He spoke with us about what had transpired.
He's well known in the police, so we stop him all the time. And one of the officers contacted him. He had a warrant, I believe, or a detainer, whatever. And during a search of his person, the officer located the debit card on him.
Daniel had an explanation for why he had Dennis's debit card. He said that it was given to him so he could purchase groceries for the home. On July 26, 11 days after Dennis was last seen, his car was found on the coast of Oregon, more than 200 miles away. But Dennis wasn't in it. Lieutenant Price told us who was in the car and how it was discovered by law enforcement.
My understanding of what happened was they got called to a domestic between a male and a female with a white car at like a gas station or a Minute Market type stop. The trooper arrived, found those two still arguing, no evidence of a domestic assault, but neither one of them had a license. When asked about the vehicle, she said she was borrowing it from a friend of hers in Phoenix named Dennis Day. She had the keys. So he chose to impound the vehicle because neither one of them had a license or proof of insurance and made no arrest, sent them on their way, impounded the car. That was on the 26th of July. On the 27th of July, our officers got called back to the house for another welfare check. Hey, see if Dennis is there. Ernie wants to see him. I started looking into it. I saw that we had been by there. Like, this was like the third or fourth time for a welfare check. I had my clerk check Dennis and Ernie for any vehicles. She found that the white Ford Escort belonged to them, and then it showed that it was impounded the day before on the coast. So I reached out to OSP. I said, hey, tell me about this. And they said, yeah, I wanted to find out if Dennis was driving. They said, no, it was these two people. And I said, okay, this is kind of odd. You know, this is now this throws a monkey wrench in there. So then I went to Ernie and talked to Ernie. And honestly, I basically coached him into saying, hey, yes, I want to file a missing person report. Nobody had ever called us reporting him missing. I went to Ernie and said, hey, do you have any idea where he is? Do you know where he could be? Do you have anybody I can call? No, no, no. I mean, Ernie couldn't even tell me what Dennis looked like right now. And I said, well, if I don't know where he is and you don't know where he is, would you like me to list him as a missing person? That way, when the police contact him, then, you know, we can check on him. And he said, yes. So that's what started the missing person thing.
After the car was located, they identified the two people inside as Lori and Curtis DeClusen. Lieutenant Price wanted to talk to them in order to find out what they knew about Dennis's disappearance. But he wasn't exactly sure where to find them, because they are known as transients in the area. Lieutenant Price entered a flag onto Curtis in NCIC, and when he went to visit his probation officer, both he and Lori were directed to contact Lieutenant Price. This is what transpired after.
Last week, I got a call from parole and probation. He showed up for his first, Curtis did, for his first meeting with his probation officer. And I think it was from either theft or domestic, one of the two. And so they call me and I show up and he agreed to talk to me. Even he's a little reluctant, but he's a little rough. But I talked to him, you know, he was cooperative and everything. And then I told him, I said, I need to talk to Lori. I said, can you get a message to Lori? And by the time I got back to my office, there was a message on my phone from Lori saying, hey, you wanted to talk to me? But I tried calling back, nothing. And then she got contacted again. I wasn't able to make that work. She got contacted in Medford. And then on Saturday, she showed up at the office. So within 3 days, I had her and we were talking. She made a great effort to come talk to me. So like I said, that was Curtis's first time showing up to meet his probation officer, which tells me he hasn't been in too much trouble lately. And she admitted that she's the one that got him hooked on drugs a few years ago. So it sounds like he was a fairly decent guy before. I don't hear their name very often unless they're being contacted for parking somewhere they're not supposed to park or anything like that. So they're definitely not as well known as Daniel. I'm sure they're making a name for themselves now, just being transient and shoplifting and stuff like that. Curtis didn't give me too much. Mostly Curtis was about the time that they were in the vehicle. According to him and Lori, and Daniel actually, Curtis has never been to the house. Lori went to the house herself and showed up at Curtis's father's house with the car, said, let's go. He jumped in. Hey, where'd you get the car? She told him that Daniel gave it to him or gave it to her because she was helping clean up the house. And so then they left and started heading towards the coast. Curtis told me that he thought that that they were in the car for about 4 or 5 nights. Lori says it was only 2 nights. So I have an issue with the timeline there. But according to Lori, when her and the other female showed up at the house, they met Daniel at the local Circle K. Daniel bought her a pack of cigarettes, invited them over. They go to the house. That's the first time Lori's been to the house. They go to the house. Lori gets a bad impression because Daniel's acting strange and sounds like he was under the influence of meth. In fact, later on that evening, he actually was snorting meth. Her and the other female got nervous. They saw some keys. Lori said, hey, let's get out of here. Let's just see if any of these keys work for the car. They found the key to the Escort. She took the car. She admitted that she took the car, and she admitted to me she didn't have permission to. And all that. She also took a laptop out of the house. So she leaves there, picks up Curtis. They stay with the night on the way to the coast. They pull over somewhere. They stay the night. And then they make it to the coast. They stay one more night. And then they're contacted by OSP and the car's impounded. And this was just last Saturday. I was off duty and I got a call. She was here. I came right in. And right off the bat, I brought her in the office. And I said, look, you know, you're free to go. You're not under arrest. There's the door, all that kind of stuff. And I said, but I do have to let you know, I have to read you your rights just because, you know, this way it works. And she goes, that's fine. She goes, I'm probably going to implicate myself. And I said, okay, we'll go, you know. Eventually she says, yeah, I took the car. I was scared of Daniel and I took the car. I know I didn't, you know, basically I know I didn't have permission. And yeah, I took the car. I also took a laptop. She's never seen, according to her, she's never seen Dennis.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. No one truly knows who the last person to see Dennis was, but his friend Kirk believes that it was either himself or Daniel, based on the fact that he didn't hear from Dennis again after offering to take him to the police department in order to report the physical altercation he had had with Daniel. Not knowing who last saw or spoke to Dennis, or even the exact time of his disappearance, has made looking for him all the more difficult. Lieutenant Price is spearheading the law enforcement investigation into Dennis's disappearance. He told us what he knows about the day Ernie went to the hospital and some of the events that took place prior to Dennis's disappearance.
I don't know exactly what day Ernie went to the nursing home, but July 13th was the day he was transported from the residence by ambulance to the hospital. He went to the nursing home for a couple reasons. One, probably the dementia. Two, his physical limitations, because he was falling quite a bit. And I don't know what that was caused from, but he was falling a lot. And also, the house that he would have been brought back to, their home, was not in the shape where people should be living in. It just wasn't sanitary. Safe as far as structurally, yes, it's fine, you know, but it's just, it was not sanitary. I mean, there's evidence of rats. There's, you know, everything's covered in like a dust, you know, dirt, grime. But yes, their house was not in a very good condition. And I believe I told either a nurse or somebody working with him, I said, look, you know, there's not going to be anybody there to take care of him. The house is not in condition, you know. And then I think a family friend of theirs who actually became Ernie's POA, Kirk, I think Kirk stepped in and helped get him into the home, knowing that going back home would not be a good place to go. So,
Lieutenant Price also spoke about what he knows about Ernie's friend Kirk and the roommate Daniel that was helping Dennis and Ernie around the house in exchange for room and board.
Kirk knew Daniel for about 5 years. He hired Daniel to do some work around his property. In the beginning, Daniel was normal. He did the work. He did good work, according to Kirk. But then he started, some of his mental illness started to show along on top of some drug use. Kirk eventually introduced Daniel to Dennis and Ernie and offered Daniel to go by the house for them to do some yard work and whatnot periodically. That turned into probably around, I haven't pinpointed the exact day, but sometime in either late May or sometime in June, Daniel showed up at Dennis and Ernie's house to do some work, and somehow he ended up in a room. They let him stay in a room. So there was some type of agreement type thing. Something was done to where, and it sounds like it was probably Ernie who instigated it all, but, you know, basically, hey, why don't you stay here? Help. Ernie's falling and stuff. Dennis can't pick him up. So I think part of it was, hey, now I got another person here to help me get up so that Dennis doesn't have to do it all. Plus, Daniel could do yard work and what. So they basically let him stay there in exchange for work around the house. But he was introduced by Kirk. He was not unwelcome. He was unwelcome by Dennis toward the end, it sounds like. It sounds like Dennis wasn't too happy with him. And that's based on Kirk telling me that Dennis came to Kirk's house and said, hey, I need to get Daniel out of there. been assaulting me or abusing me, or one of those two words. And Kirk said, well, what are you talking about? What happened? But he said he assaulted me. And Kirk said, well, let's go to the police. It was a Sunday. He knows our office is closed on Sunday as far as the building goes. So then they decided they were going to come on Monday to come talk to us. And that's when Dennis said he had to go to Walmart to fix his phone. Kirk never heard from Dennis again after that. So it sounds like Dennis didn't really want Daniel there. Now, when I interviewed Daniel, Daniel claims that Dennis was also experiencing some dementia, because one minute he would have him go out and do some weed eating, and then when he'd come in, Dennis would say, you need to get out of here. You know, he was flip-flopping his emotions. And but this is coming from Daniel, who himself has mental issues and possibly something to do with this. So
Daniel sounded suspicious to me. After looking at his extensive criminal record, I started to wonder if he and Dennis had gotten into some kind of fight, and Dennis was injured. Lieutenant Price shared that Daniel is known to law enforcement in the area, and whether or not he thinks Daniel could have hurt Dennis.
Oh, he's well known. I mean, Phoenix is in a valley. It's not a major city, but for us, it's a bigger city, Medford. And then, you know, we're all in line along the highway, and but we all pretty much work together for the most part. And yes, he is very well known throughout law enforcement, mainly for trespass, you know, shoplifting. The way Daniel comes across to me is, let's say they did get into an argument and they did go too far and Daniel did, you know, something happened to Dennis. I see Daniel dropping everything and running. I don't think he has, I mean, I could be totally off. I mean, and I'm not hanging my hat on that. I'm just saying that my interviews with Daniel, my contacts with Daniel, is he would just take off and probably not be around here. I mean, he remained here in Phoenix for months, you know, and he's transient, but I mean, he never distanced himself. There was none of that. So, but, and that could be his, you know, his mental health issues too. I mean, you know, we tried to arrest him one day on a warrant, and he flat out was like, there's, you know, I don't have a warrant. You got the wrong guy. And we're like, dude, it's you. You know, we take you to jail all the time. You know, so.
There's been some speculation about how Daniel's recent move into Dennis and Ernie's house plays into Dennis's disappearance. Kirk has known Daniel for several years, so we asked him to tell us more about Daniel.
You know, known him for the 5 years, and at one point I would say we were friends. I tried to be of help to him, but he's not a very big guy, and he certainly is a strong person, and typically very, very peaceful. But one of the things, he started doing methamphetamine. As soon as you start doing that, all bets are off. Anything is possible, so... I'm actually the person who introduced Dan into their lives. I've known Dan for about 5 years, and he was had been working, doing some outside work for me, and I would often hire him to go in and make an attempt to try to clean up their house a little bit. Their house was in almost unlivable, you know, so it was really horrible, but I would hire Dan, and then as they had a few dollars now and again, they would hire Dan as well to help Dennis in maintain the yard and the house some. And Dan had become homeless, had some brushes with the law. And so when he worked for them at times, they would let him stay a night or two so that he would have shelter. And so that, I don't know how long, but typically only a few days at a time. And that was one of those sessions. And he said, you know, I'm trying to get Dan out. And I said, okay, well. And then he told me that Dan had assaulted him and knocked him down, which then I became very angry. And I said, well, one of the difficulties you have is for more than a few days, they suddenly have some residency and you can't just kick them out. But I said, I know how to take care of that. And he had actually gone by the police department, but because it was Sunday, the police were closed. And he said, dial 911, which he was reluctant to do. And the second thing he needed was he had bought a new phone from Walmart and he didn't know how to work it. Well, I'm 62 and from that generation, and so I'm technically challenged. And I said, I barely can understand my own phone. So I suggested, you need a phone. And so I said, why don't you go back to Walmart and have them show you how to unlock it and make sure that you have it up and going. I said, and then give me a call and I'll meet you and I'll go down to the police department with you and we can have the police called and help navigate that. Well, I did not hear from him the rest of the afternoon. And so I had assumed on home and that Dan was gone, no big deal. Found out within the next couple of days that that was not the case. And that's when he showed up missing.
Another odd piece to this story is that one of Dennis and Ernie's neighbors has come forward with some information. According to her, she heard two men on the property arguing and heard one of them say, "You tried to kill me." This neighbor also found a note on her property that concerned her enough to go to the police. Here's Roseanne on that.
A note by Dennis in his handwriting was found by the neighbor, Sherry Workman, in her driveway, and I do not have a date as to when that was found, and that's something I would like to know. She says that she took it to the police immediately, and I didn't get that directly from her. That's either something she put on the page or that I got from the family who talked to her. But supposedly when she found the note, she took it to the police immediately. It was later dropped onto Lieutenant Price's desk. Shortly after he opened the missing persons case, he had not been aware of its existence before that. So I don't know when that note was found. It was dated the 14th and attested that Daniel had hit him in the head and hands. It also stated that Dan threatened his life, but that part of the note had been scribbled over in the same pen that wrote the note. The threatened the life part was scribbled over. The way the note appeared, it gave Dan's name, but in a way that made it look as though Dan might have signed the note, though that doesn't make sense. It's been verified by the family that it was Dennis's handwriting. We know that the note had a bad address on it. It had the house address, but it had the wrong street name on it.
We asked Lieutenant Price about the note, and he confirmed that the address was incorrect. It listed the address as 9th Street, but Dennis lived on Pine Street. Strangely enough, Lieutenant Price also mentioned that they don't even have a 9th Street there. He said the note also has an area code for a phone number, but not the rest of the number. Lieutenant Price confirmed what Roseanne said about the body of the note and added that it said, "He assaulted me and I," but the I was scratched out. The letter is signed with Daniel's name, not Dennis's, which is strange. The family believes that the note is written in Dennis's handwriting, but that isn't something that has been confirmed by any kind of expert. We know that Dennis had a cell phone that has never been recovered. He had told Kirk he was going to Walmart to get some help with it. By the time Lieutenant Price got this information, Dennis had been missing for about 3 weeks, and the phone appeared to be off. Since that time, the phone number has been reassigned. Lieutenant Price is still working to obtain more information about the phone. When Daniel spoke to Lieutenant Price, he said that Dennis said he was going to visit friends and left on foot with his dog. Well, the dog was later found.
I could see Dennis taking his dog and leaving and thinking he's got to go somewhere, but I don't know where he would go. I know that their friend Kirk Peterson was going to take Dennis to the police department. Dennis had told Kirk that Dan had hit him, and Kirk had offered to take him to the police department. They found his dog. I will not believe anything else. Dennis would never leave without his dog. Well, supposedly Dan said that that Dennis was carrying the dog, but the neighbors found the dog running loose. That's something I know very well of Dennis. It's one of the things we shared, with an insane love of animals. And if Dennis thought that Daniel was in any way, shape, or form dangerous, especially, he would not have left his dog there. He certainly wouldn't have been going away without his dog. Would not have done it. Would not have liked going to stay with friends. That's why I am certain. There's no question in my mind. There was no question in my mind when I heard that fact that something bad has happened to Dennis.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. While speaking to Kirk, we wanted to know more about Ernie's health limitations and what caring for him entailed for Dennis. Did Dennis feel like he was no longer needed when Ernie went into the nursing home and became depressed? It had only been a few days, so that doesn't seem like a realistic possibility. Kirk told us more about some of Ernie's health challenges and how he stepped in to help Ernie after Dennis disappeared. Without Dennis to care for Ernie and take care of the household affairs, Kirk felt like someone needed to step in and act on Ernie's behalf in order to manage the household finances and ensure that Ernie was taken care of properly. While it's clear that Ernie suffers from some memory loss, Kirk told us that he's not aware of an official diagnosis.
I don't know if he's actually had that diagnosis. What he does have is massive short-term memory loss. So he can't remember whether he had breakfast or not. He's a very intelligent man that speaks 5 languages and was very accomplished in his own time. And this week I took him, I've been taking some things hanging in his home and moving them to his studio. He lives in assisted living. I took pictures of a bunch of pieces and he said, "Oh, definitely bring me that one. That was a special gift that I'd given to Dennis." When I brought it in, he goes, "Oh yeah, that's beautiful." And he said, "I believe the name of it is homage to," and the Dutch name, "Lederhosen Heidewolfsen," or whatever. And my eyes kind of lit up because I questioned him all the time. And I said, "Yeah, that's exactly the name," because I looked at it the day before when I cleaned it up and was looking at the painting and looking at the back. So he really is quite interactive. What he does have is he had colon cancer, so his colon's been removed, so he has a colostomy bag. And he has a low-level diabetes, but, you know, he takes care of himself. He needs help. And the only thing that has him living, assisted living, that he couldn't stay at home is that short-term memory loss. The brain is very peculiar, and so he doesn't remember that they even feed him there every meal. And, well, where's the dining room? What's downstairs? So it's a very complicated issue. So he can communicate, and he remembers. Ernie was a large man, 6'3", probably close to 300 pounds. Same time that Ernie would fall, Dennis couldn't physically get him to his feet and get him back in the chair or back in bed. So they would call the fire department, and quite often if he fell, the fire department would transport him to the hospital and check him out just to make sure that there was no other problems. And so Ernie had one of those failures and have gone to the hospital, and they keep him for a couple of days and just check him out and make sure that he's in good shape. Ernie was due to come home, and Dennis was on my front porch that Sunday morning. He was there and said, "I need your help."
As the search for Dennis commenced, Roseanne, Kirk, and the Phoenix Police Department's Lieutenant Price immediately started looking for family members. But no one could quite remember who Dennis's relatives were, and this posed a challenge in looking for answers. Roseanne told us what the search for Dennis's family was like.
But one of the things that the lieutenant had asked me right away was, "Have you heard anything about a sister of Dennis's?" And at that point, I couldn't remember. Interestingly, I remembered when somebody asked me if he was left-handed, and I knew right away he was, as did Sylvia, as did my husband. And I don't know why we did, but we couldn't remember if he had a sister. Certainly not one that he would have been talking about a lot, but maybe, you know, she could have figured in one of his stories about his early life. And I couldn't remember. I know that in recreating things, you know, because it was one of the things I asked Kirk and I asked other people. I said, you know, I asked on the page, does anybody know about this? We have a friend who does certain amount of genealogy kind of thing. So I sticked him onto. I said, figure out if Dennis had a sister. And he couldn't come back with anything. And then somebody told me, yeah, I think he did. And I think her name was Velma. So here I am looking for a Velma day, you know, somebody who was born Velma Day. I found three Velma days, none of whom were at quite the right age or right timeline. I was at a dead end. So I find it ironic that I was trying so hard to find his family. Meanwhile, you know, they're not found. And when we finally did, when one story was aired and one relative of theirs saw it.
Kirk told us about his search for Dennis's family.
I got power of attorney for Ernie fairly immediately. So I started this arduous process of cleaning up the bills and paying the bills. I'm on his checking account and I take care of his fees. And I was picking up his mail, but initially they wouldn't let me have Dennis's mail. And then this comical showdown with the postmistress. And, well, if you pay for the rental of the box, you can have a key and then you can have Dennis's mail too. And so I was looking, and as I've been cleaning out the house, was looking for evidence. It's not like Dennis kept a phone book. There was a phone list on the wall with some numbers on it, which included my number, but his sister Nelda wasn't on it, nor was his other sister Kathy. Well, we since have found out Kathy passed away a couple of years ago. And so when I started picking up the mail, when they finally started giving me Dennis's mail, it might be a Christmas card from either of his sisters. And so here comes a Christmas card from Nelda. It's like, okay, great. So I open it up. There's a Christmas card. Number one, the Christmas card was addressed to Dennis. I opened it up and there was a check for $50 to Dennis and a little note. I hope you and Ernie are doing okay. Merry Christmas. I immediately voided the check out. I'm a businessman. And so with the intent of, hey, I'm going to send down a letter to you saying, here's your check. And oh, by the way, Dennis has been missing. Well, it was exactly at that time that they made contact with the website.
Eventually, a news story was aired about Dennis's disappearance. One of his relatives saw the story and called his sister Nelda in order to let her know that her brother was missing. Since that time, Nelda and her family members have joined the search. We spoke to Nelda and asked her to describe her relationship with Dennis.
Well, you know, Dennis and I, my mother thought that, you know, she wanted to make a great actress and actor out of it, tap dancing duo like Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. Most of our time was spent going to lessons, you know, dancing lessons and stuff, and, you know, in school, just regular kids thing. And when he was about 12 years old, he was hired on by Disney as one of the original Mouseketeers. That kind of limited our relationship because he would get up, they would get up early in the morning and leave and not come home until late. And so, and then by the time he got through with that, you know, he went off to college and so did I. So but we had a good relationship. And, you know, it was just a normal relationship of any brother and sister. Our relationship, you know, wasn't real close in the past years because Dennis wanted to kind of live his own life in the gay communities. And, you know, we would go and visit him on occasion. And when my mother was alive, we saw him a lot more.
And then he, of course, he's in Oregon and I'm in California, and I have my big, I have a big family down here. And, you know, they would come, Dennis and Ernie, his partner, would come for Christmas occasionally. And then after my mother passed, that kind of separated from that. And so anyway, what happened is, I had gone up to see him, and I always checked on him because he kind of wanted to keep his life, you know, away from the family. I don't know why, but you know, I would send him cards and pictures of all the kids and the grandkids and the great grandkids. And he never responded much, but my daughter and I, the last time we saw him, we went up in 2017 and we visited with him. And at the time, I didn't see any problems with his emotions or his, you know, his being stable.
I mentioned earlier that the police were unable to find family members of Dennis when he first disappeared. But Lieutenant Price did look for them. He shared what he did to attempt to locate Dennis's family.
The mail doesn't go to the house. The mail goes to a post office box under Ernie's name. Kirk has power of attorney. You know, I told Kirk in the beginning, you know, if you find something, let me know. And in the very beginning, he told me he thought that Dennis had a sister named Nelda, but wasn't sure of the last name and thought she lived up in Vineta, Oregon. And I reached out to them and tried to do what I can with the first name of Nelda and couldn't find anything. So that's what took so long, is just lack of information about Dennis himself.
When Lieutenant Price began working on this case, he went to visit Ernie to try to gather more information. He told us his assessment of Ernie's cognitive abilities.
The day that I went there to talk to him, he was able to answer questions as far as where do you live type stuff. But when I asked him about Dennis, what I asked him was, I said, well, the picture I have of Dennis is 10 years old. I said, what does his hair look like right now? Like the last time you saw him when you went to the hospital, what does his hair look like? I don't know. Does he wear a certain shirt every day? Does he wear a certain hat every day? I don't know. He couldn't answer those type of questions. He couldn't answer me who any of his friends were, where he might have gone, anything like that. In that case right there, then that made me think, geez, you know, I don't think he'd be able to legally, you know, answer anything either. But Kirk, who's had regular contact with him, said that he has good days and bad days. There's days where he does remember a lot, and there's days where he doesn't.
Despite the concerns of Dennis's family, Lieutenant Price has found no evidence that a crime occurred either in Dennis's home or his car.
I was looking at the walls. I was looking at the ceiling. I was looking at the crevices, you know, looking for any type of cleanup or anything like that. Now, I will say, the night that Daniel had the two females over, the two transient females, one of them being Lori, they wanted to do some laundry, apparently. He said, well, that's fine, you know, why don't you guys help me clean up and stuff? So, and there was a trash bag sitting on the couch. It had a bunch of trash in it, you know, nothing bloody, nothing like that. But somebody obviously did try to mop toward the back door by the bathroom, but they didn't do a very good job. And, you know, it wasn't a very good mopping. And I was looking at that real close yesterday, and there's still no evidence of any blood or anything. It's just smeared dirt is what it is. You would definitely know if a section of that house had been cleaned. It would be so obvious. This property is, it's not on the street. It's behind another house. It sits next to a cemetery. It's tiny. It's old. It's decrepit. You know, I just went by there yesterday because after my interview with Lori DeKluzen, she had said some things in the interview that made me go, maybe I should go look at the house again, you know. And so I went back by. I went up in the attic. I looked as far as I could in the crawl space, you know, where anybody could fit. And I checked all the cabinets. I checked drawers. I checked the freezers. I checked everything. Obviously, there was nothing there. We'd have a different conversation.
The police also searched Dennis's car, and Lieutenant Price made a good point about how the car was so messy that any evidence of a crime or a cleanup afterward would have been painfully obvious. He described what was located inside the vehicle.
Initially, when I found out it was impounded, I called the tow company. I said, hey, treat it like evidence. I'm going to have somebody come look at it. I reached out to OSP. I said, hey, can you guys go back there, search that car, photograph it. I'm looking for any evidence of a crime. And I let them know it was a missing person, you know, in suspicious circumstances, whatever. And so they went back out. The trooper went back out there, photographed it. I even had him take a small little aluminum bat out of it. It had no evidence on it by looking at it. Nothing on it. No dents, no blood, no nothing. And that's the other thing is it didn't look like, and I asked the trooper this, and looking at the photos, it didn't look like there was any passengers in the car. The two front seats were taken, but the back two had stuff on them. So property, miscellaneous stuff. But I don't know. I feel like I've been as thorough as I can, but like I said, I mean, I'm not some professional missing person magician or something. I don't know.
Dennis's family is understandably frustrated that they were not aware of his disappearance for so long. Additionally, Nelda is concerned about some of the things that were going on in Dennis's life and the events that transpired after his disappearance. This is what she had to say.
They said that Ernie took a fall, and they called the ambulance, and they hauled Ernie off in the ambulance, and, well, Dennis was, you know, having some depression about taking care of Ernie and everything. And so a friend stepped in, which Dennis didn't really like. And he said, let me send this man over to live with you. And he'll help you and take care of your house and whatever. So this guy did come, and Dennis didn't want him to be there. Dennis wanted to take care of Ernie, wanted to take care of the home, but everybody else said, no, this would be a good idea. So this man came to live with him. And he had previously lived with the man that sent him. And the man that sent him said, oh, yes, he didn't tell everybody this, but he, this man is kind of has a mental problem, and he was on meth, and he would get drunk, and he didn't want him living with him. So he sent him over to live with my brother. To supposedly to help because of the mental state of the man in the home. And the police officer says, I just can't believe he could do anything like that. But yet the man that placed him there didn't want him in his home because he was drinking and on meth. And I mean, I used to work at the prison and volunteered for the Narcotics Anonymous. I know how violent they can be on those drugs. And Dennis was saying that he was abusing him, and nobody did anything about it. Ernie is in a rest home up there in Oregon, and he is this gentleman who took over his POA has got him on Medicaid, and he's being well taken care of. The officer told me in Phoenix, he said, I personally went down and went through the house, attic, underneath the house. They have a cemetery out in back. I don't know. It's an old cemetery. He says, I walk through the cemeteries. I walk along. There's a creek there. I walked along the creek. He said, I didn't see any signs of anything. And that's when we pressed, and supposedly they're bringing in cadaver dogs now, and they're going to redo the search.
In addition to some suspicion about Daniel, Nelda is also concerned about the role that Kirk played in introducing Daniel to Dennis and Ernie. As we discussed earlier, Kirk is now the power of attorney for Ernie. Nelda believes that there may be some ulterior motives at play here.
The man that placed the man in my brother's home, you know, we've investigated everything. He has a prior of taking over POA on an old elderly woman. And that's what he jumped right in and took the POA over, over Ernie. And then he didn't tell anybody, but he also has an antique store. He has a printing shop also. And we looked it up on the deal, and it said, selling Mickey Mouse, or Mouseketeer memorabilia. And, you know, it just not ringing well with me. And I think he placed that man in my brother's home to go ahead and get rid of my brother so he could take over the POA for his friend or what. Because it was just all comes down to that man having people in that home that took Dennis's car. Dennis disappeared. But I'm just sick about it.
Kirk told us that he had only taken CDs to sell in his consignment store. and solely for the purpose of paying the bills. I checked out his website, and this appears to be the case. Additionally, all profits from the sale of the CDs go directly to benefit Ernie. Even though CDs are not a necessity, I wasn't sure whether or not this could possibly pose a conflict. I wanted to learn more about Oregon's laws on elder care and the aging population, so I spoke with an attorney from Oregon.
My name is Brooks Cooper, and I have been a lawyer since 1994. I practice in Oregon, Washington, and a variety of federal courts. For about the past 17 years, I have focused my practice on what I generally term probate litigation, which includes financial abuse claims by the elderly. It includes contested fiduciary matters and elder law matters protecting elderly folks, among many, many other things. In Oregon, to sign a power of attorney, you have to have what the law calls contractual capacity, which is the highest level of mental functioning we gauge in the law. It's what everyone over the age of 18 is presumed to have, and it's generally sufficient cognitive ability to handle your affairs as a reasonably prudent person would. The way that I like to sort of phrase it is, you're on the ball enough that you could go to a used car lot and not get taken advantage of by the car salesman. You got to have that capacity to grant a power of attorney. There are two flavors in Oregon of powers of attorney. One is simply a power of attorney. That one is only valid so long as you, the grantor, also retain full capacity. So if you grant a power of attorney and then you have a stroke, you get dementia, whatever, then the agent's authority lapses. If you intend the agent's authority to continue no matter what your capacity, which is usually what people who grant powers of attorney want, then you grant what's called a durable power of attorney, which specifically continues for the remainder of your life, even if you yourself lose capacity to manage your affairs. So an agent under a power of attorney, the technical title when you're an agent under a power of attorney is you are the attorney in fact, okay, as opposed to an attorney at law.
One of the things that I asked Mr. Cooper is if the power of attorney would be expected to pay Ernie's bills, and if it would be acceptable to sell off some of his assets in order to pay those bills. This is what he had to say.
The general fiduciary duty is to manage the grantor's assets, income, and affairs for their benefit. So if there are bills that need to be paid and there is no income to pay them, then it is appropriate to look at selling some asset or perhaps taking a reverse mortgage on the home, things that you may need to do to generate money. But yes, if you're the power of attorney and the water bill is delinquent or the mortgage is overdue or whatever, then you should be doing what you can to use their assets to get their debts paid so they don't go into foreclosure, have their water turned off, whatever the bad act is. If you're selling it in your own consignment shop, that's a bit problematic because the law expects the attorney, in fact, not to use their power to personally benefit. So, you know, I'd need to know more facts, but if this person is going to get whatever the consignee's cut of the sale price is, maybe that's appropriate, maybe not. You know, if there's 10 consignment shops and his is the most expensive, maybe not. But maybe this is the most efficient way to turn those CDs into money, assuming that needs to be done in any case.
We heard Kirk talk about how Ernie suffers from some memory loss. Someone with these kinds of health problems may not have the capacity to understand what they're doing when they sign over power of attorney. So we asked Mr. Cooper about this and whether or not a familial relationship matters in these situations.
And that doesn't differ based upon what your relationship is. If the person was impaired at the time the power of attorney was granted, so we have a question whether the agent ever validly had power or not, ideally someone who cares about the grantor would step in during their life and open a protective proceeding. In Oregon, we call that a conservatorship, where we ask the court to deem them financially incapable and then appoint someone to manage the money, like an attorney in fact, but it's appointed by the court. And that person accounts to the court every year. They must post a bond. There's a lot of restrictions, so things don't go awry. If no one stepped in prior to the person's death, then to the extent the attorney, in fact, dissipated the estate, spent money that didn't need to be spent, whoever the heirs are who are receiving a smaller inheritance, or the devisees if they had a will, or the creditors if there's not enough money to pay the last bills and there would have been but for the bad acts, any of them have the authority to challenge the grant of the power of attorney and ask the court to declare that at the time it was granted, the person didn't have capacity, and that the agent knew it, because if the agent is purely innocent and has no idea they're doing something wrong, it's obviously a more difficult situation. But the court can declare that the power of attorney was invalid when granted, and then scrutinize the agent's conduct. So if the agent, you know, just simply transferred things to themselves in the very easy sense, we can either get that back or impose a money judgment for the value of it if it's gone. So those things can be rectified after death. It's much preferable to do it during life because we can stop the bleeding, as it were, and stop the loss. Assume for a moment that the grantor lacked capacity. The attorney, in fact, nonetheless goes out and acts, and everything they do is exactly proper and is what should be done. Well, they haven't caused any harm, even though they may be technically acting without authority. If they haven't caused any harm, it's kind of a no harm, no foul.
Finally, I wanted to know what steps we can take, no matter where we live, to best prepare ourselves for the later stages of life. This is the advice Mr. Cooper had to offer.
So at this point, the things that all of us who are, you know, facing aging, and as most folks age, they will experience some level of mental decline. One thing to do is select a trusted friend or family member who ideally is at least 10 years younger than you, to whom you can grant a durable power of attorney. Another thing to do is think about creating, as an estate planning tool, a trust to place your assets in the trust, and have the trust have a mechanism to trigger when you need to stop being your own trustee and your chosen trusted successor can step in to manage your assets, because they're all kind of in one place at that point. Another thing is simply to talk to those in your, you know, your circle, whether it's your given family or those you've chosen to make part of your life, and make sure they're generally aware of your condition and your wants and desires. And on the physical medical side, to execute an advance directive so that if something very catastrophic happens and you can't communicate, your wishes about end-of-life care are already known because you sat down and wrote them out. All of those are things that can and should be done. And frankly, I'd argue that, you know, once we become sort of adults in this world, it's time to start thinking about that, because there's no rule that says that you can't have some medical catastrophe at age 38. You don't have to be 80 for this to happen to you.
So what happened to Dennis Day on July 15th, 2018? This is a case with a lot going on, but only a few clues to go on. We know that Dennis told Kirk that Daniel had hit him, and Daniel says that Dennis walked away with his dog, saying he was going to visit some friends, and the dog was later found running loose. Lieutenant Price says that he's found no evidence that a crime was committed in the house or the car. We know that Lori stole the car and a laptop, but she's been forthcoming about that. Nelda has her suspicions about Kirk's motives in all of this, but Lieutenant Price says that Kirk has been helpful and cooperative. Kirk was also very open to speaking with us about the case, and the fact that he stepped up to help Ernie in Dennis's absence. And what about that weird note the neighbor found? Did Dennis really walk away on foot with his dog, as Daniel has claimed? If he did, where did he go? Was he despondent over Ernie and simply walked away? Has he suffered some sort of health crisis and just hasn't been found? Or did someone harm Dennis? Why would he voluntarily disappear with just the clothes on his back? Dennis's disappearance has left his loved ones and law enforcement with so many questions and not a whole lot of clues to go on. At the time of his disappearance, Dennis Day was 76 years old. He was described as 5'7" tall and weighing approximately 150 pounds. He has brownish gray hair and brown eyes. If you have any information about the disappearance of Dennis Day, please call Lieutenant Price with the Phoenix Police Department at 541-535-1113, extension 309. You can follow Dennis's story on Facebook at Find Dennis Day.
My first priority is to go visit Ernie, because of they are like many elderly gay people that back in the day when they came out, their biological family basically was alienated from them. They never had any children, and as their friends have been dying off, I asked him one day, this is, you know, a year and a half ago, I said, is there anybody besides me that comes by to visit or check on you? He just stared at the wall and shook his head no. You know, there wasn't too many people to interact with and to help them.
To be honest with you, being such a small department, and we've had so much turnover, we've lost so many guys to our local sheriff's office just because more advancement, more things, you know, offerings for them. But so we're constantly training new guys. So, I mean, we don't have that many long-term experienced officers. It's me, the chief, you know, we've been on the longest. And honestly, I've never been a detective. I've always been street level. And so I learn from these every single time. And this one here, I've learned a lot because it's been open for so long. At this time, yes, I have nothing that screams to me involuntary. You know, Lori, I told her, I said, look, you understand that I can arrest you right now for the stealing of the car. You admitted to me. And she goes, yeah. And I said, but the bigger picture is Dennis. And I said, I would rather have you help me, which means I could probably help you, you know, if this thing goes right. I said, but understand that you very well may be charged with the theft of the car and the computer here in the future. And she said, she goes, I understand that. And she's still being cooperative. So the logical thing, looking from the outside, reading all those articles, is you're going to look at Daniel. You know, everybody's going to look at Daniel. He was the guy that lived there. He's the one who supposedly assaulted, even though we've never gotten a call for an assault. You know, the logical thing is to look at Daniel, but I have looked at Daniel. I've done what I can with Daniel. I don't think he's playing dumb when I talk to him. I mean, we've dealt with him so much that, you know, it's the same every single time. And that's not to say he didn't do anything, but at this point, I have nothing. If anybody has any information about the whereabouts of Dennis Day, I would greatly appreciate a phone call. You can reach me directly at my office at 541-535-1113, extension 309.
That brings us to the end of episode 168. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us for the show. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on The Vanished, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to contact me, there's a page and a discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Wondery.com, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There's a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Join me next time. I'll be covering a case from Minnesota. Thanks for listening.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
your favorite coffee shop down the street, to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.